Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Just like that, the second hour is here. Tim Brando will join us in 20 minutes on Hot Mic, Putnam Withrow, 6th and Peabody Air location with Yeehaw Beer and Old Smoky Moonshine. We've got a full Final Four preview coming up. Chad, what award did Adam Sandler recently? He got something over the weekend, I saw.
Yeah, so it was the Kennedy Center Honors, and it was the Mark Twain Award for American Comedy Excellence. It was something like that.
Multiple people came out and like roasted him or parodies of songs.
So, you know, we're going to start doing some things on the show with just things that catch our eye that we want to pass along, you know, sort of recommendations, but things that we want more people to see or to experience, right? There are certain things you watch or you take in and you say, well, that's probably just for me. I don't think a lot of people would enjoy that. That's more my thing. I don't want to share that with the world. There are other things that I'm like, I want everyone to acknowledge this and to honor it. I fell into a rabbit hole this morning. A wormhole rabbit hole. What are we going with here?
Whatever
you want to call it. I always hear both, and I don't know which way
to
go.
Your choice.
If it's online, I guess it's a wormhole, maybe. Anything else, a rabbit hole? Either way. A wormhole, rabbit hole, whatever you want to use. I'm online, and I start seeing these videos on YouTube of people honoring Adam Sandler in Washington, D.C. at the Kennedy Center for this Kennedy Center Honors, the Mark Twain Award for Adam Sandler. And I'm hearing Chris Rock and David Spade and Rob Schneider and Jennifer Aniston and Drew Barrymore and Conan O'Brien and Steve Buscemi and all of these great comic people and actors and everything else talk about Adam Sandler. And I am hooked. I end up watching every single one of the tributes. They're all probably 4 to 7 minutes long when they go up there and talk about him. And then I watch the 12-minute acceptance speech from Adam Sandler. And I just can't stop thinking about this today. This guy is such an American treasure. It is amazing how he has treated his friends that he met along the way. He's talking about Eric Lamensoff that he had elementary school with and he grew up with back in New Hampshire where he's from. Talks about his brothers and sisters. His mom is there in the crowd. Talking about his mom, his wife, his two daughters. But every step along the way, how he's carried his friends along with him. When he makes a movie, they're all in the movie. Rob Schneider gets choked up talking about it, saying, I still have a career where I'm in movies simply because Adam Sandler is my friend, and he wants to hang out with me, and he thinks I'm good, and he passes along that confidence that he has and brings his friends along in movies. And it really is remarkable when you think about this guy's career. Now he's made, you know, it feels like 1,000 movies. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. I will watch all of them. He's going to put out 3 or 4 movies a year on Netflix at this point. I will probably sit down and watch all of them. The latest one's going to be this Murder Mystery 2 with Jennifer Aniston. Watch the first one, enjoyed it. I'll watch this one, I'll probably enjoy it as well. But Adam Sandler is so unique in his sense of humor. And everyone that went up to honor him talked about the first time they met him, thinking, who is this guy that just speaks gibberish and does Opera Man and Cajun Man and all these crazy things and has this sense of joy and craziness, but also confidence just to be himself and be wacky that way.
But also doing movies now that aren't even like that.
Yeah, now he can be a dramatic actor with Uncut Gems and Punch Drunk Love back in the day with Paul Thomas Anderson that got a lot of acclaim also. Very talented, but just remarkable life and career for this guy. And every time I see him speaking, I'm thinking, he's one of us. Like, there are certain celebrities,
for sure.
You know, I love Leonardo DiCaprio, right? But I watch Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, go up and speak about, you know, climate change. And at an award show, and I'm thinking, he's probably not like me in a lot of ways. Like, it seems very important. If I met Leo, I'd think, this is very important. This guy is very important. If I meet Adam Sandler, I'm thinking, I want to go have a pint of beer and play a game of horse with this dude. That's the way he comes across to everyone.
Leo, you go on a yacht with his 25-year-old girlfriend.
Right. He's going to bring out a, you know, just a plethora of Russian models.
Right.
Adam Sandler's not that guy, but, you know, Hutton, we saw him live. You know, Conan O'Brien did the best job, by the way, of just going ruthless, like roast. Like some of you know, everybody kind of started as a roast and then went into some. Ben Stiller was another who was really good.
Was talking about Patrick there?
He may have been there, but I didn't see him present. But Ben Stiller's presentation was really funny. Steve Buscemi came out as his character from Wedding Singer, where he's the drunk brother giving the toast of the wedding, and he's got some whiskey in his hand, and he's like toasting Adam Sandler while making fun of him. But everyone that talked about him, just the friendship he has with everyone, how he takes care of his buddies, you know, takes care of his family, I just found it very inspiring. I'm watching it thinking, whatever you want to say about some of Adam Sandler's stupidity or dumb movies he's made or whatever, I find most of his comedy hilarious. And maybe it's because of my age and that was my formative years watching Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison and Wedding Singer and
Little Nicky.
Waterboy, Little Nicky. I mean, the list goes on and on of great, to me, Adam Sandler comedies. But I'm thinking,
Spanglish.
What an amazing dude and an amazing career, Spanglish.
Spanglish.
We celebrate all of his rom-coms, 50 First Dates.
Spanglish, for the record, is the only movie I've walked out on. I was in high school at the time, and I was just like, man, this is awful.
You must have not been on a date.
No, I was. Oh. We both left. This was not what we expected.
That's true high school love right there when the girl you're with is also like, yeah, I don't want
let's
this.
Go.
I don't want to watch.
Let's bounce.
I only want to watch Adam Sandler making funny voices and being a preschooler.
Yeah, at that time, I didn't want to see the serious Adam Sandler like I do now.
Yeah, Taya Leone is in that picture, by the way, and I'm a huge Taya Leone fan.
The picture. It's gone from film to picture.
It's a picture.
Spanglish is on a different shelf for Chad. It's a picture.
I love referring to movies that should not be referred to as pictures or film as both. That would be one of them. I enjoyed Spanglish. Not my favorite Adam Sandler movie, but anyway, I would pass that along.
Now.
That's the and you'll get into it. And it's like every story is kind of similar. Chris Rock's story is great about he just goes in the first time he saw Adam Sandler on stage at some comedy club in New York. And then how they hung out that night, and they've been really good friends ever since. But the first joke he remembers Adam Sandler telling, I'm not going to ruin it because Chris Rock does a better job than I do of retelling it, but it's a hilarious joke that he told on stage because he was angry that this young guy had the stage on a weekend night and Chris Rock couldn't get that at that point. Then he heard one joke from Sandler and he said, oh, I get it. This guy's really good and funny and unique. I love Adam Sandler. That's what I wanted to say more than anything else.
I'm eager
to. I love the guy.
We're friends with Nate Bargatze, who's really catapulted up into the stratosphere of comedians as a clean comic. And now he's playing arenas across the country, not just comedy clubs or small venues or smaller venues. I shouldn't say there are 2,000-seat theaters, not small, for the circuit he's on. But now he's moved on to the arenas. And Chad, whenever we were watching Sandler play, last month?
Yeah.
Bargatze was there backstage to kind of get a feel for what it's going to be like for him whenever he takes the stage on April 15th.
Well, he got a photo with Sandler, right? Didn't he post that? I'm so jealous.
He was checking out the whole mechanics of everything. But Nate's going to be in studio with us next week, so we'll ask him about Sandler behind the scenes.
You stole my thunder with that one because that's one I want to get into because – I think Sandler is the perfect example of he's blue, right? I mean, his comedy can be very blue, and his comedy albums are blue, but he doesn't have to be. You know, there are certain, like Chris Rock could not be a clean comic. That's just not who he is.
Right.
Dave Chappelle, I think, could go either way, but he's probably never going to be a totally clean comic. Nate Bargatze is a clean comic. I don't think Nate Bargatze could be a dirty comic. Adam Sandler could do either or. He can do family movies where he doesn't say a single cuss word and be hilarious.
And do SNL.
And he can do the bits that we saw on stage in Nashville that are some of the more R-rated things you could ever hear that are hilarious. And it goes either way with that guy. And I just think his life is incredible and the way he's lived it and had fun and brought his buddies along with him the whole time. It's a great lesson, I think, for everyone. And you don't hear a single bad Hollywood story about Adam Sandler like being a jerk to someone. You know, you don't hear the comment, I was a big fan of his, and then I met him backstage, and he did this. You don't hear one thing negative about someone who's done a movie with Sandler, where he was a prima donna or he was rude to people around the set. He's got his own production company now. He basically writes, directs, edits with his friends everything he does.
And they're all on Netflix now, right?
Yep. He's got that long-term deal with Netflix where he's doing all that with Netflix.
I want to know, too, within that inner circle that they're in every film with him, who's the last guy to join that inner circle? Because there's really no new people that join into that, right? Who's the last guy that was allowed into the group?
That's a good... Kevin James, I think, would be the latest addition. He's been in a lot, you know, recently.
Yeah.
But he wasn't there from the very beginning.
Yeah, he was in Grown Ups.
Yeah, well, even like Norm MacDonald, you know, who's in Billy Madison, was early on, RIP Norm, who's another great comic legend. Conan O'Brien laughs that they were buddies at SNL when Conan was a writer, but he hasn't appeared in one Adam Sandler movie. Unlike everyone else that was there, has not been asked to be in one of them. So he jokes that he must have done something wrong. And he said something about, you know, he did offer me one role in his latest Netflix movie, but called me and said I had to give it away to my Uber driver instead. But then I found out the Uber driver was Rob Schneider, is what he said, which was
the last guy in the group might be Dan Patrick.
Dan Patrick has been around in movies with him since The Longest Yard, which was 2004. So going on 20 years now.
They always find a role
for him. But I think Kevin James didn't come along until even later than that. And he's been in almost everything since.
Yes, because Grown Ups was debuting at the Super Bowl we were at together. One of them. And we went and saw that. Hit us up with your thoughts on this. And so you saw this on YouTube?
This was on YouTube. I think the actual thing aired on CNN originally. I don't know if that's available anywhere. But you can catch all of it on YouTube. And it's just, I just watched the presentations to him and the acceptance speech. But it more than that, it made me think about Sandler just seems great. And it's so few times that you have entertainers that you just think, man, this guy just seems awesome. But not just you want to hang out with, like, he's just a legitimately nice, fun-loving guy that's like the rest of us.
We are going to preview the Final Four in a few minutes with Tim Brando. Ticket prices... Way different for the women's Final Four compared to the men's Final Four. But the Elite Eight matchup between Iowa and Louisville in the women's bracket, that drew more viewers than any NBA game on ESPN all season.
That blew my mind.
Over 2 million tuned in to watch this game. And Caitlin Clark, the first 40-point triple-double in NCAA tournament history, that's men's or women's tournament history. That also is a stat that blew my mind, considering the players that we've seen come through the tournament and had very special moments. What a great performance by her. And now the Final Four matchup headed to the women's bracket. Well, the ticket prices, way different. It's tough to get in to the women's Final Four, which will begin on Friday. And compared to the men's bracket, no surprise, those ticket prices have plummeted at NRG Stadium for the men's side of things before we even get to the championship matchup. I'm eager to see where the peak can be for the women's Final Four and the numbers, based on the numbers that ESPN is pushing for what we saw in the Elite Eight.
This is a great moment for women's basketball. The Caitlin Clark story is awesome. I think the best story for the game, South Carolina fans won't like this, but I think it's if undefeated South Carolina got upset.
Yep.
Either semifinal or national championship, just to give another spark of intrigue with everything. It's also a cool story if they run the table and finish off the undefeated season. A great moment for women's basketball, though, and that fact about rated higher, more people watched that game in the Elite Eight.
Yes.
Not even Final Four, more than any ESPN NBA game this season. That blew my mind. I had to read it four times before letting it sink in that was the case. So that's really good for women's basketball.
And no surprise, right, with the men's matchups, starting with FAU and San Diego State, that, I mean, if you want to get in, Chad, you mentioned this on Monday, if you want to get into the game, go to the Final Four for the first time, hop a flight, hotel prices are probably down as well, and the tickets are cheap to get in.
I did think about...
Into the cavern of what that stadium looks like.
I did think about this. If Leah Thomas played basketball, what would the ratings be? If Leah Thomas was in a Final Four?
Tons of people would tune in.
I think it would be like NBA Finals level. If that Elite Eight game between Iowa and Louisville outrated all NBA games on ESPN all year, a Leah Thomas basketball version playing in a Final Four would outrate the NBA Finals.
Well, I mean,
period.
Because you have you either are on the side.
Oh, I'm not saying I don't want it to happen, but yes, everyone would naturally want to tune in for that.
Yeah.
And there's a single person that wouldn't say, well, I hate it. Most of America would hate it, but they would hate watch it.
Yes,
they'd be rooting like hell for whoever Leah Thomas was playing. And everyone would tune in for that. I'm tuning in for Caitlin Clark in the Final Four. I mean, it's caught my attention now. I'm going to watch this game.
And I would have said, like, the Friday Final Four tip-off would be detrimental. It wouldn't help. It wouldn't hurt, but it wouldn't help. Now I think there's enough buzz around it to where they can skyrocket with the numbers.
Well, the ticket prices are so much higher for the women's game. There's a 55,000-seat difference between the venues, between NRG Stadium and American Airlines Arena in Dallas. And it's a lesson to the men's game. Go to arenas. You can charge, even if your attendance is double, you can charge double to get people into the building in a 20,000-seat arena. And that atmosphere will be so much better than these cavernous football stadiums these games are played in.
We will not see a Final Four at Madison Square Garden. Think about that. Because it seats 20,000 and not 80.
And how awesome that would be.
It'd be great.
To see.
It'd be great. Tim Brando previews the Final Four with us. He joins us next on Hot Mic across the Outkick Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
And we're joined by Tim Brando, talking some Final Four, but the matchups are set, and a very unexpected four-pack. Tim, thanks for the time, man. Hope you're well.
You guys actually called me again after the disaster that was my first bracket and the equally disastrous revisioned bracket. It's great to be with you. It's great to be with you again.
How do you describe this Final Four?
Unlike any other. My friend Jim Nance loves to say, the Masters tradition unlike any other. Well, the Final Four this year, which will be his last. And I do want to mention this about Jim, because we came up at about the same time. He joined CBS in 85. The same year I went to ESPN. I'm a few years ahead of him on the calendar, but his career was off the charts and incredible. He was a very, very welcoming lead broadcaster when I joined CBS back in 1996, and a dear friend, and I wish him the best on his last Final Four, because it's something that matters a lot to broadcasters when you look at the time you spend on something as big as that. And in my case, my largest opportunity was to do a regional final of the NCAA men's basketball tournament with Al McGuire. Can't even imagine what he went through to do as many of the national championships as he did and be a part of this event. And I came up in Louisiana following LSU and Daddy Dale Brown at the same time he was coming up a few years later than me with Guy Lewis at Houston. And I know it means a lot to him, and I want to wish him a great weekend.
Well, and Tim, as a national broadcaster of games like yourself, I couldn't help but think about Jim Nance in this and think that if Jim Nance thought that his final four, I'm sure in his mind he's thinking, boy, we're going to have Duke in there, North Carolina and Kansas or Indiana. He's going to be calling a national semifinal game between San Diego State and Florida Atlantic to tip things off. I mean, you said unexpected. I'm just thinking for Jim Nance's final four, and no disrespect to these teams who have earned their spot in this, this is not what a broadcaster of huge events would expect for a huge event. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you are. And let me tell you why.
Okay, tell me.
On the face of it, okay, and particularly those of your generation and maybe a little bit younger, and not to get caught up too much on the generational aspect of sports, but Jim is a storyteller. I'm a storyteller. Everybody that you see at the national level of broadcasting, we fashion ourselves first and foremost as storytellers. That's who we are. That's what we wanted to do all our lives. I know probably in his heart of hearts when he made the choice to step away now, and I do believe it was his choice to do it in Houston with a team like Houston that had a chance to play before its home crowd, was in his head when he made that choice. But at the same time, if someone knocked them off and it happened to be, oh, I don't know, a team that no one expected to do it, so be it. And to see those other teams out there, like Florida Atlantic and San Diego State, Mountain West, Conference USA, that's history. And as a broadcaster, that's something you want to be a part of. Being a part of a history-making event is something that we dream of. So I think he's smiling, even though he might, you know, in his heart of hearts be thinking, gosh, I thought my alma mater would be there. The reality is he's still got an amazing, historic Final Four to tell the story of. And that's a storyteller's dream.
I totally agree with you on the storytelling part of it, and there are great stories here with these four teams. But Sean McManus of CBS, he was quoted a couple of years ago saying that, hey, what we want are the big-name teams, right, in this game. But there's going to be big stories, and you talk about the stories. My question for you, Tim, do you care at all about ratings when you're calling a game? Is that just something up for the executives, or do you care one bit?
No, that's for the executives and the salespeople. No. Has nothing to do with how we feel. Let me tell you something. When I was broadcasting high school football games at the age of 14 in a cherry picker somewhere in Plaquemine, Louisiana, I was so excited to be doing it. And I knew that those, 2,500 people that were interested in how Plaquemine might do against Neville High School in Monroe, Louisiana, to me, I felt the world was watching every and hearing everything that I had to say on the radio. And that was in 1971. The size of the audience doesn't matter. The loyal people that are listening or are watching, the parents of those kids, the grandparents of those kids, they're going to be on the edge of their seats with everything you say. I can't tell you how many times I've been stopped, not just by those kids that played in games that I called, but also the parents of those kids in games that I called. Years ago, when Billy Donovan was making his run to a second national championship, I ran into his father, William, whom I had known since Billy was in school at Providence. And he came up to me and he said, "You're one of our favorites." You know, he was a Northeastern New England guy. And he said, "Whenever we're having a bad day, Tim, we'll put in that 87 game at the Providence Civic Center when it starting at God, number 34, Billy Donovan was playing. We were at the game and we were watching you and Raft on our VHS tapes. And so whenever we're having a bad day, we put that old VHS tape in and we watch Providence take down the mighty Hoyas for the very first time under Rick Pitino." You know, that kind of stuff is what it's all about. That's what drives guys that are in our business that are calling games, because we know no matter who wins or who loses, memories are being made for a lifetime for those families.
Tim Brando with us on Hot Mic. I have picked Florida Atlantic to lose every game in this tournament. And as I'm going to the Final Four and watching these matchups, I'm thinking, am I really going to do this again? Because they've played 38 games. They've won 35 of them. Their three losses came on true road environments. And they didn't lose a game by less than 13, by more than 13 points. What do you make of the Owls and the fact that they're known for shooting the three, and while they have caught fire some, it's not nearly to the extent that we saw and what they point to the regular season and through the Conference USA tournament. What can they do, and what would it mean for either FAU or San Diego State to win the championship this year?
It's a life-altering experience and a program-altering moment for both of them just to be in the Final Four. Let me take you back to 2011 for a second, when the undercard in Houston, which unfortunately for Houston, I think we're going to have a great Final Four. I think all three games will be competitive. That year in 2011 was probably the least competitive Final Four ever. And the reason it was because we had all these incredible upsets through the course of the tournament. I think Bucknell out of the Patriot League had taken out Kansas. I had worked in D.C. for the first two rounds when the 8-9 winner in the Duquesne-Butler game, this was Butler without Gordon Hayward, but with Matt Howard, they had won on two tip-ins near the buzzer to take out both Duquesne and Pitt when Jamie Dixon had a number one seed at Pittsburgh in the second round. It was VCU and Butler in the undercard, okay, and UConn, who with Kemba Walker, I had them in D.C. as well. Kemba was leading that team through that incredible moment in the Big East where they were 500 in the conference, then won the Big East tournament, and then didn't lose a game the rest of the way and went on to win the national title. All those games were bad. Butler beat VCU by a lot. Shaka Smart's team couldn't make a shot. The iron was really unkind the whole game. And then Butler got VCU's disease in the championship game and lost by almost 30 to UConn, which was not representative at all of the season that they had had. Sometimes the tournament, after so many upsets, will exhale and you'll have a few bad games. But that's the only time that I ever remember being at a Final Four, and I've been to all but four of them since 1981. That was the only time I can recall all three games being non-competitive, that they were blowouts. The teams had just horrible games at just the wrong time. I don't see that happening here because FAU has got older, established talent that's won all but three games. That's legit. That makes you totally legit. They have a young coach that's feeling like, man, you know what? I was tutored under Bob Knight. A lot of people have no idea how much I know and how good my team is. They're playing with house money. And I think they are absolutely in a position to beat San Diego State, given the way the Aztecs came through their region. Simultaneously, here's a veteran coach on the other side whose dad was a coach at Minnesota with some of the greatest teams Minnesota have had through that century, Jim Dutcher. Brian's his son. He was really the instigator of the Fab Five. Steve Fisher counted on him to recruit all those kids that played 30 years ago. And now he is finally in a position to be at the reins of that program. And he has guys that can finish and guys that will play on defense with as much zeal as they play on offense. The winner of that game, I'm just going to say this to you right now, the winner of that game, the undercard, will be thought of as a blowout victim in the national championship. Look, I've been wrong all through this tournament with my bracket. Same. I've got F papers on top of F papers. But I'm going to tell you, the winner of that undercard game has a great chance, I mean great chance, to win against the winner of the Miami-UConn game, which I believe everyone that's in that building on Saturday will think will be the winner of the national championship once they win the semifinals. They may be right, but they might not be right because I think Florida Atlantic is really wired offensively and defensively to do a lot of damage to whoever wins that Miami-UConn game. San Diego State's a bit one-dimensional. They win one way and one way only, and that's through their defense. There are more finishers on the offensive side for Florida Atlantic than there are for San Diego State. But these are two veteran teams, fellas. Either one, okay, is capable of winning it all. And I think most of America, and especially the media, is painting a completely different picture. Oh, there's no reason to watch. These are not traditional schools. There's no blue bloods. There's no this. This just in. The NCAA basketball tournament isn't for the writers. It isn't for the broadcasters. It isn't for those pundits out there that think they know more than they know. It's for those kids and the coaches, first and foremost. And I think either of these four teams are capable of winning it all.
Tim, we had this discussion earlier in the week, and your answer to the question is a great example. If the national broadcaster doesn't care about ratings, the college basketball fan shouldn't care about it either. So even if the ratings are bad, that should not affect the enjoyment of the fans that are tuning in, right, watching really good basketball and really good stories. Speaking of good stories, Jim Larrañaga gets George Mason to a Final Four and now has Miami in a Final Four. Two different programs he has taken to the Final Four. Tim, where does that put him on the list of some of the great college basketball coaches we've seen in this sport?
Oh, he's on the A-list. You know, think about all the great coaches, Hall of Famers, that either got to one Final Four with one team over their entire career. Louis Carnesecca comes to mind. Think about all the great coaches that maybe won more than 700 games, won, you know, a half dozen Big Ten titles, never went to a Final Four. Gene Katie's name comes to mind. There are so many out there that have not gotten to the promised land, which is the Final Four. As I was coming up as a broadcaster in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and hoping to one day get an opportunity to call NCAA tournament games, I'll never forget the joy, the glee that was coming from Al McGuire when Ray Meyer finally made it to a Final Four, the icon at DePaul. And he finally got there. And I thought to myself, my God, it's almost as if it doesn't matter whether he wins at the Final Four. And for Al, he told me later, because I got the privilege and honor of working with him in a regional final back in 98 in St. Louis, that's true. That's exactly the way it was. For coaches, just to get to the Final Four, the hardest game to win is a regional final. Ask any coach. They'll tell you. Hardest game to win is the regional final to get to a Final Four. Once you're there, sure, America, and particularly in today's climate, it's the brass ring or forget everything else. One of the great aspects of the NCAA basketball tournament is there are really five winners. The national champion, absolutely. They'll talk about it forever. So will those players. But to just get your program to a Final Four as a head coach, there's so many great coaches that never got there. And to be one that did is absolutely amazing. And to do it twice at two programs that are outside the so-called Power Six, which is what Jim Larrañaga has done, is off the charts. And I first met him in my first national broadcast with Dick Vitale, January 5th, 1985. I went to Charlottesville, Virginia, as a kid from Baton Rouge that was 29 years old, hoping and praying that this on-air audition would get me an opportunity. I met both Jim Larrañaga, Dave Odom, who coached at both South Carolina and Wake Forest, Terry Holland, who's unfortunately passed away. Seth Greenberg had just been a GA there on his way to a coaching career at Long Beach State and later at Virginia Tech. I'll never forget that. I will absolutely never forget that. And I think Jim Larrañaga has a chance to put himself in a position because of all he did as an assistant at Virginia, for what he did at George Mason, but to close it out with a potential national championship at an ACC school not in the Carolinas is the cherry on top. I mean, and he's a guy that was a great player first at Archbishop Molloy in the Bronx, New York, and he coached as a player would coach, meaning he was a player's coach, but he had just enough ability to strike a little fear into some of those players of the next generations without enjoying being a player's coach. you see how much those guys love playing for him. And what he's done in constructing a team made up of a lot of transfers and a lot of veteran players that love to play one-on-one basketball, he's adopted an NBA style, really. Let's spread out and let's match up. Our guards, our forwards, mano a mano. Let's play man-to-man or street ball to some extent from time to time. Not necessarily think about running sets and a lot of offensive plays. He's 73 years old, and he's coaching like these guys that are 33 and get NBA head coaching jobs. It's an amazing, amazing feat.
Tim, who wins and advances to Monday, and who ultimately cuts down the nets? And let's also just mention it to set this up. UConn has won their four games in this tournament by a combined 90 points.
Which is a concern.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
and let me tell you why it's a concern. When you're winning games in blowout fashion, as Danny Hurley has, and let's begin with this. I have great respect for Danny and his entire family. I've known his dad and his brother, his whole family for a long time. And Danny exorcised some demons through the course of the regular season. I saw some of his low moments calling so many Big East games on Fox. I thought it was really genuine of him to say when he was being interviewed last week before the regional final, hey, I stopped getting on the refs and I started concentrating on coaching my team. He's growing as a head coach. He's still not a finished product, really. But when you have won games by that margin, I'll take you back again, how history repeats itself. Tark the Shark wins the title, blows out Duke by 30, 33 years ago. A year later, they're undefeated. They go into Indianapolis. They have to play pretty much the same Duke team with pretty much the same Vegas team. They get behind by one, have to make a play at the end. No one knows what to do. Larry Johnson's dribbling the ball, and it's like, okay, never been in this situation before. Well, Connecticut, not all year, but certainly in this tournament, has not been pressured. They've not been in a situation where somebody's got to make a big play. Who's going to be the guy? And as many great players as they have, and no one's got more talent, more depth of talent at every position on the floor other than Connecticut, they don't have a true prolific point guard. When they lost those games in midseason in the Big East, it was because the scouting report in the Big East was Tristan Newton is a good lead guard. He's not a point guard. He's not a great distributor of the ball. So let's attack him first, take him away, and then when the shot clock's winding down, who's going to make a play? Is it Jackson? Is it Hawkins? Is it Caravan? Who's it going to be? Well, sometimes that could be a real problem when the heat is on, when pressure really becomes a factor. And that old axiom, pressure will make a pipe bust, can be problematic for UConn, who's considered to be the runaway freight train team that ought to win it. That's the narrative going into the Final Four. I think Miami's going to be a hard team for them to beat. I really do. But if they win that game and get to the championship, then I think having to be in that role and playing against either San Diego State or a team like FAU, those teams are going to muck it up. They're going to make it ugly. They're going to turn it into a foul fest, and they're not going to let guys get easy shots. So UConn will have to earn it, even though the narrative is going in, they should just blow by the rest of the competition. I'm picking UConn to get through it because I do believe in their talent, and I think Danny has really grown up as a head coach, and good for him. But I think a lot of their fans, and some of them I used to work with at ESPN, are like, Brando, please God, don't pick UConn because we've seen your bracket. but that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick UConn.
Same here, going into it for sure. And I'll probably regret that too as we watch the Owls or the Aztecs.
I'm telling you, I think if FAU beats San Diego State, I really think they got a chance to win it all. I think San Diego State
that will
beat
be
up FAU.
Amazing.
I think San Diego State will struggle against UConn because they have so many answers offensively. But FAU physically on both sides, on both offense and defense, I think could match up well with UConn.
Tim, you're always great. Thank you so much once again joining us. And, you know, we'll have to have you back on soon for sure. We need to recap the season at some point.
Hope to do it. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Tim. Appreciate you.
Hit them straight on the course. Tim Brando there, Fox Sports. Always great to us, and a great analysis there, looking ahead to the Final Four. We'll do that throughout the rest of the week. Chad, there is a trial that is must-see right now. Davey Hudson's got the latest next on Hot Mic.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Clay Travis will be with us in roughly 30 minutes here on the Outkick Network for Hot Mic. Chad, did you see where DJ Hernandez, Aaron Hernandez's brother, was arrested last week for throwing a brick at ESPN headquarters? And there was a note attached to it discussing their harmful commentary. Stories at Outkick.com. But, I mean, the note attached to it and the direct nature of it, I reminded me, you don't mess with the Hernandez family based on the details of that trial and how everything went there.
Well, it's also unfortunate that they're all in Bristol, Connecticut. That's where all of his running around growing up took place, and that's where his family's located.
And his the note was to all media outlets, but it was thrown at the ESPN headquarters there. The assumption is stemming from the coverage of Aaron, but last week,
well, I think that there's been some reporting that they're upset with the insinuation that he was gay. That, you know, that was the Netflix documentary, though, where they had his boyfriend, basically, from high school interviewed in it. And I think the family was really upset with that and coverage on it.
But that was back in 2020.
Yeah. And that wasn't ESPN.
No.
So, whatever.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he's been arrested there. A more humorous nature, there's a civil trial going on. Davey Hudson with more on Gwyneth Paltrow and a very short man who got in a skiing accident with her.
Thanks, Hutt. So, as we all know, after the Murdaugh trial, going back a little bit farther, the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, we needed something new. Well, guess what, guys? I'm combining them both right now, and that's what we have with this Gwyneth Paltrow skiing hit and run trial is how we're deeming this. And just before I even get into this, if it already sounds like it's the most white thing that could happen, it is exactly that. I mean, we just have wealthy white people going to battle over issues such as, I'm getting ahead of myself. So Gwyneth Paltrow, back in 2016, was accused of hitting a retired optometrist named Terry Sanderson. Man's now 76 years old.
Very white right there. Yes. Just that last sentence.
So he initially sued her for, I think it was $3.1 million in damages because on their day on the slopes at this really nice ski resort in Utah, he fractured some ribs. He ended up suffering a concussion. And so he is saying, like, Gwyneth Paltrow is the reason this happened. Now, the $3.1 million lawsuit was filed out, they dismissed it. And so then he filed for $300,000 in damages. And that is what we currently are witnessing. The judge put an 8-day cap on this trial, but it has delivered every day. We're on day 7 right now. I'm pretty sure my math checks out there. And so the best thing that I've seen from this, I know you've been following it a little bit.
I've watched a little bit of it.
But this man, Mr. Sanderson, contends that because of his injuries, he is no longer able to enjoy wine tastings.
Yes. Well, the other really funny thing about it, and by the way, I think there's nothing here that would lead me to believe that Gwyneth Paltrow caused these injuries. That was, you know, negligent in some way. She's also countersued for, what, $1?
$1, yes. You know, it's just the the morality
funny, the
of
funny
it.
Thing though is in the deposition he claims he's 5'8", right? And then at the trial he testified he was 5'5".
They had to measure him.
Yeah,
they had to break it out and see if he was telling the truth.
Yeah, it's it's crazy.
We had an issue because the entire trial is about being downhill, because if you're uphill, then you're likely the one that caused the accident. So Gwenda said, no, I was actually ran into by this guy. And the way she phrased it, she thought she was being sexually assaulted on the slopes because the guy's skis ran into her skis. And when another body ran into her back, she heard a grunting sound. Yeah. She's like, as I'm trying to understand this, she thought she was being sexually assaulted.
She was.
The guy runs her over and just realizes this is Gwyneth Paltrow from Seven. Oh my God! Yes, he finally.
He rides up. I love your candle. Just goes
oh,
off.
Oh my gosh! So many jokes. Gwyneth Paltrow is also under heat because she's been touting her own diet of like celery juice and a cracker for the entire day.
Yeah,
and people are saying that she's endorsing unhealthy eating habits. And she said, "No, this is just when I detox. This is what I do when I detox. This isn't normal. I mean, actually eat food."
If she's endorsing unhealthy eating habits, stop asking her about her eating habits. That would be my answer.
Oh, but she's
reply
in such
that.
A place of power, you know, to so many people. They have to do whatever Gwyneth Paltrow says.
She went,
by
the
founder
way,
of Goop. You have to follow what she says. Come on, Hutton.
She got up from the accident, proceeded to go downhill, and then went and had a massage without asking if the guy was okay.
The only thing she lost was a half day of skiing.
Can she still enjoy wine tastings?
Headlines next, including the latest on the holdup between the Jets and Packers and Aaron Rodgers.